The Thirsty Developer, episode number 16 for March 22nd, 2008. Developers or diviners? So Larry, last week we had a great episode with Adam Kenny where we had a chance to talk with him about, you know, kind of this whole, you know, developer designers, you know, Silverlight's this very interesting technology, getting a lot of buzz around the industry. You know, people really paying a lot of attention to it. From a development perspective, you know, this is kind of new territory for us because it's all about creating sort of rich and engaging applications, and so we're kind of continuing this trend about, you know, talking about developers and designers, or are they diviners, are they developers? There's kind of this terminology going around, but you actually had a chance this week to talk with somebody about the whole kind of convergence of designers with developers.
Yeah, I was really interested in, you know, hearing the conversation with you and Adam, and wanted to follow that up with a conversation with a designer, because we focus a lot when we're having the discussion about designer and developer collaboration on the tools, and the tools have come a long way. But I wanted to talk more about the process and communication. And basically, when I called up Kevin Farner, you know, from Gamal Design, local design company, and said wanted to do a podcast, you know, I was asked, like, well, you know, what would the topic be? And I was like, well, let's just say, you know, how can developers, you know, suck less as designers? And he said, interesting. Come on down and we'll talk about it. So we spent a lot of time talking about kind of the process of design and things that designers and developers could do, you know, to get along better, you know, because right. We're all part of one big process.
Yeah. And the thing that I guess really that's important to make here is that just because now we have the tools in our sort of our toolbox to help us with design doesn't necessarily mean that we are designers. I mean, it's still an art, there's still a science behind it. And so I'm actually really interested to hear what Kevin has to say.
Let's roll the tape.
Let's do it.
Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm here on site at Gamal Research and Design in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I'm here with Kevin Farner. Kevin, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Kevin Farner. I'm director of our Minneapolis office, but I'm here in Milwaukee this week, and I've been with Gamal for a couple of years and been a customer of theirs for about 15.
Wow.
So
it's a lot of good history there, and you liked it so much you joined the company.
Exactly. You know, I couldn't quite buy it like Remington Shaver, but liked it enough that I joined the company.
So real quick, you know, what do you guys do? I mean, heavily, you know, focused on design because that's the first thing in the title of the company, but kind of what's your sweet spot?
Sure. The name itself is Gamal Research and Design. Our mantra, our focus is all about the users, the user experience. So the research part comes in doing user research, doing field studies, understanding the users, depending on the client, that can be broad or it can be very narrow. And then design aspect is we take that user feedback that we've collected and we use that to inform the design.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, in the industry because 5 years ago we were all about UI, the user interface, the mock-up and all that. And really there's, you know, people have recognized that, yeah, that's important, the look and feel, the color palette, all that kind of stuff. You know, it can keep an ugly application doesn't get used, but that doesn't mean it really hits the user spot. Now we're focused on the user experience, which is much more than the UI.
Absolutely. You know, if you think about it, there's in fact, I can think of a Scoble post a year or two ago that it generated some healthy debate about is ugly okay? And he was talking like with MySpace and Craigslist. But the issue is that in terms of the user experience, the design in terms of brand, color, that's only one aspect. And really, when you think about the user experience, you're talking more about the interaction design, the workflow. Are we making their lives easier? If you look on the back of our business card as an example, it actually, the word on the back, we have one word, it says simplify. We definitely are in the camp that says it's not about featureitis. It's not about adding more features.
Yeah, and you know, Microsoft's been kind of guilty of that. I loved last year, or no, it was a few years ago when we released Visual Studio 2005, and we had like, you know, the tagline was 400 new features, and everybody kind of pointed to that as, well, you know, everybody else is doing simplified, you know, less features, you know, less is more kind of, and here's Microsoft touting new features. So we've gotten kind of a bad rap on that one.
Yeah. And the interesting thing with something like a Visual Studio, and this is true of a lot of products that are made for developers, is that a lot of times every one of those new features is an icon on the homepage. And yeah. you just throw one more thing up there. And again, it's a good example of when we are asked to do something, that's an example of something we look at and we try to organize it around the user's tasks. So it's not about dumping features on a homepage. It's not even focused primarily around what's the, you know, top navigation. It's what are the users trying to accomplish? And we're going to design the site or the interface around what the users are trying to do.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I invited you on the Thirsty Developer was because I think that we need to mix things up. You know, we've covered a lot of, you know, we've covered some architecture topics. We've covered some process topics with Scrum and all that. I really wanted to get a design angle on here because, you know, Microsoft has been touting since we, you know, announced about a year and a half ago, this expression suite of tools, you know, tools, you know, from Microsoft, you know, for designers that really allow designer developer collaboration. Mm-hmm. I think the tools are great. You know, it's fantastic that we share a common file format, but that's really only the first step because, you know, we as developers and then you as designers need to have, you know, need to figure out how to work together because there's always been this wall between the two organizations.
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things is common language is a challenge. You sometimes have designers talking in one language and developers in the other. One of the things that I've experienced is that a designer can't sit over the developer's shoulder and critique the code, right? That's just, I can't say, well, that's really not elegant code that you've got there. You really could clean that up. That's just not something I can do. But anybody can sit over a designer's shoulder and say, I think you should move that to the left. Or, you know, everybody's a design critic.
Right.
And that's not a bad thing. But I think that sometimes what that can lead to is an antagonistic relationship, whereas what you're really trying to strive for is that collaborative relationship.
Yeah, and I think communication is very important. I've actually sat in on design meetings, and everybody was speaking English. They were using words that I understand, but I didn't understand what they were saying. Because we do speak a fundamentally different language. You know, on the development and architecture side, we call it a prototype or a proof of concept, and you as designers call it a comp. And I think that if we had like just a quick translation between the two, we'd see that there's probably more similarities than differences. One of the ones that I always point to is, you know, in a developer tool, it's a toolbox with all these different tools in it. And in a design tool, it's a palette.
Right. No, absolutely. You look at some of the tools, whether it's a Photoshop or whether it's an expression suite, and it really is at that fundamental level that a designer is looking at it in one way that, and therefore the product designers are calling it different labels. And that's really all it is. It's just different labels that ultimately are trying to achieve the same goal. You know, I kind of look at it that a good designer, so again, I'm talking about somebody who's looking at it from the standpoint of the user experience, is focused at it from the user's experience and how to then make the product work for the user. And fairly often, a developer, not all of them, but a lot of developers, they'd still want to do that, but they start with the table. So they think about it in terms of the database.
Right.
And they back into the user. In fact, I was just, a real quick story, I was just at a site looking at what the developers had created, and the only reason that they had tabs on a particular screen had to do with the fact that each tab was a different table.
You could tie it exactly to the database. You could go look, and there's the customer, here's the orders, here's the order details.
Absolutely. And it wasn't how the customers wanted to work at all, and they knew it. And I think kind of part of the point of this conversation here is they didn't know what's next. They knew that they were stuck. They knew they wanted to make it better. Their hearts were in the right place. They said, we want to make this easier to use. How do I go about doing that?
Right.
Which is what their question was.
Do you find that oftentimes you're kind of pulled in very late into the process?
I would say that it really is going to depend on the client when it relates to that. Because of the fact that we also do the field research at Gamal Research and Design, if we do a full project, we're actually involved pretty early, and that works out really well.
Yeah, that's ideal, right?
Yeah, that's really kind of our sweet spot. If we get invited to do, let's say, an expert review where we're just reviewing something after the fact, or somebody says, we've already done the field study, and what we really want to do now is do the design, and, oh, by the way, we've already created the product, then that is an example where we get drawn in rather late to the process.
And that's another thing where there's a lot of commonality from a pattern standpoint. As an architect, when I'm brought in and they say, well, we've already done the business process work. You don't have to worry about that stuff. You just have to worry about the system stuff. That's a red flag to me because, you know, if it was produced by somebody else, A, I'm not familiar with it. I don't understand it. I didn't hear it firsthand. And not that I have to be involved in every part of the process, but, you know, really there's a doubt, there's an uncertainty whether that work was actually done. And I think it's probably the same from your standpoint.
Absolutely. And in fact, when we put our contracts together with our clients, we will state right in the contract that this has to be a multidisciplinary team when we really are starting to collaborate. We can't have it be us going off into a cave and then coming out with, you know, oh, look, the design is here. And it's got to be a team that includes people from the development side to make sure that they understand why we're doing what we're doing. And I absolutely, on the architect side, you know, and the architect doesn't come in, you know, with the last 2 weeks of the project just to make sure everything's okay. And it's the same thing on the design side.
Right. So I'd like to talk about that, you know, that sometimes, you know, artificial wall and sometimes a real wall. Sure. Between the design team and the development team. Because, you know, the tooling, I think that, you know, both Microsoft and then Adobe with their coming Thermo project, we're going to nail the tooling side so that the tools speak kind of the same language. But the handoff to me is always kind of where we, and both sides, I fundamentally believe this isn't a design problem, this isn't a development problem. That's where we fall apart.
I agree. And I think in certain ways, so in my past experience in corporate life, in corporate IT, I also had the project management underneath me. And I think one of the elements is on the design side, there's a lot of struggle about when do the design and developers start getting together. So to a certain degree, you know, you were talking about Scrum. To a certain degree, I think some of it's a project management issue, that if you're managing a development project, you're still thinking about it and, okay, this is the design phase and therefore we don't need to bring the developers in.
Yeah.
And I think so that's the challenge, is that any time that you actually treat it like a handoff or an over the wall, that's the first sort of red flag that there's an issue.
Yeah, early and often is when the two groups should be talking to each other. There's always a balance, right? Because you don't want somebody dedicated full time to the team who's right. Doesn't have, you know, a full week's worth of work to do every week.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, and I sort of avoid the religious holy wars between waterfall and agile, but I think there's when you think about the agile, sort of the daily stand-up meetings or whatever you want to call those meetings, that's an example of, even if you don't actually do agile project management, that if you got a developer and they're not needed full-time, just have them come to those daily meetings so that they can hear what's going on with the design. We had a lot more success, whether it was with Gamal projects or whether it was with an internal project, when we had the developers just on a daily basis knew what was going on and then let the designer also give them an opportunity to talk through the learnings and do it separately than from when maybe they're talking to the business, because right. it's two different that's two different conversations as well.
Yeah, and I think also the important thing is that, you know, there's a part in the project, and I don't know if it's a, you know, a specific date you can point to where, you know, the development ramps up and the design kind of ramps down, right? Because at some point you have to lock things. Mm-hmm. But I think the other falling is when, you know, the designers are just pulled out of the project. Even if they were talking beforehand, when the designer disappears, things can start going awry. And I'll give you a specific example.
Sure.
You know, I have a friend of mine who's a designer, brilliant guy. You know, worked on a project with a large company. You know, everything was going well. When they shipped the product, he looked at it and screamed. Right-clicked on it, said, who put tables in my tableless design, and you know, had a, you know, 100 things wrong with it. And he was very emotional about it.
Sure.
And I think it was, you know, purely a communications issue, right, is that because he wasn't involved in there, he couldn't adapt it. And the developer will always fall back to what they know because they've got a ship.
Absolutely. So the first response to that is, we are a huge, huge proponent in terms of the Gamal methodology of iterative design. And that's all the way back to paper prototyping. We're huge proponents of paper prototyping. You can learn so much early on and so quickly with paper prototypes. So you scratch up the screen, you put in is this a pick list, is it a checkbox, a radio buttons, you put that in your paper prototype. On our projects, we will bounce paper prototypes off of end users. But it's also good in terms of working with developers, because developers will be able to spot some problems even in that paper prototypes. Hey, we don't know how to do that. We don't have a control like that. You know, whatever the case may be, you can spot those that early, and therefore the designer can make the changes. Because one of the things I think that we do pretty well too is we recognize and understand constraints. We don't get up in our ivory tower and say, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, we're stopping this project because you're telling us that you can't do something. We recognize that every company's got constraints. And so you can resolve a lot of those during the paper prototype session. Once you get into the design session with the developers, you're absolutely right. You still have to have the developers are starting. The designer still has to be available to answer questions and to review what's going on. One, because again, developer may run into a problem and say, we can't do that. I'm on a project where there's a platform group and a developer group. The platform group does a lot of the underlying stuff. If the developers can't have access to something in the platform, they can't do it. And so then they let us know. We say, okay, we can't do it this way because it's not available to us. And so then you work on what the next best thing is.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, about iteration, because I think that the design competency has always been a lot better about iterating than the development competency. Mm-hmm. And we're figuring that out on the development side. We're getting the tools and more than that, the processes in place to allow us to iterate, more quickly. But we have to figure out, you know, as an industry, you know, this isn't a company specific thing, you know, how we can iterate together from a design and development standpoint.
I think, that's a case where I think, you know, 12 to 24 months from now, I think that's a case where the tools actually will help along with the communication piece. When you can get to the tools that, you know, I can think of, 5 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, you know, you try to do a Photoshop, you have a nice beveled edge or a nice round edge. And, you know, people are like, oh, that looks really nice in Photoshop, but I can't do that. You know, so when you start getting to the point where some of the tools of this is what I mocked it up as, and the code will be able to generate that, I think on a prototyping standpoint and on an iterative standpoint, that is really going to help a lot.
Yeah, I think that'll overcome the user interface components, because rounded corners, when they got hot a few years ago, I would look at them and go, oh wow, that's like really hard.
Right.
You know, do you know that? You know?
Right. Exactly. And when you talk about common language, that's a great example where I don't think a lot of designers knew because it's really easy in Photoshop any tool. But I think that that's another example of the communication side where there's just not an understanding from the designer side of, wow, that's something that's very difficult for a developer to be able to do. And again, to talk about that early so you understand the trade-offs.
And once we nail the UI components, getting us to both understand what's hard, what's easy, and getting the tools to make them, you know, all easy, you know, that's step one. But then we've got, you know, a designer who throws an interface with, you know, customer and associated customers together. There's a second kind of conversation. Now we're getting into the domain of the business problem where we can go, our back-end legacy system doesn't support that kind of relationship. You know, and again, that's going to be really hard. Mm-hmm. It'd be really easy for the designer to go, oh, well, let me refactor that. Let me go back to the users. You know, let's maybe do a different view of that that's not so hard to support. I think that we need to lick the, you know, fundamental, you know, it's block and tackle. To have the tools to be able to support rounded corners, then we can get into the real issues of the domain. Issues.
Absolutely, yeah. The last company I was at, we had a billing system that was a legacy, 15 years old, and we wanted to get it down to a two-step process for the people in the field to be able to submit their time and billing. I mean, that's how the company makes their money.
Yeah.
It could not be done. It had nothing to do with the user interface. It had to do with the back end. The back end demanded a three-step process. So you just recognize that constraint, and you work with the development team, and then you bounce it off some users to make sure it's clear. But you say, okay, this is what we've got to do. It's three steps. Let's make it as crystal clear three steps as possible. Two's not going to work. But you're right. It's the next step after that, because we had a deadline, the next step after that is to say, okay, now we're going after the business process issue, which is, how come this is still a legacy issue? And let's start talking about the business process to reduce that thing. Because it really ultimately was a business decision that was in the legacy, but it wasn't a technology issue. It was a business process issue.
Yeah, I love the charts that show how cheap it is to find a bug early in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're coding, if you find the bug, it's a lot cheaper than when you're in production, a lot cheaper than when it's in testing. I think the design and even the paper, you know, the paper mm-hmm. screen that the designer throws out can find bugs even earlier than, you know, the developer can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I know one of the things that we talked about before we started here was just about how can developers do some of this stuff? And this is a good example where one of the things a developer can do, we used to call it a hallway usability, which is there are certain things that you can find that it doesn't even have to necessarily be, okay, I found my target user and this is who it's going to be. Find somebody who's not familiar with what you're working on and ask them a couple questions. Not, hey, do you like this? Ask them a task-based question with a paper prototype. And if you've got a glaring problem, this person that we called it hallway usability because we'd grab somebody walking along in the hallway, we'd ask them to do it. We would spot stuff. They would say, I don't know where to start. I'm not sure what to do here.
What is this?
What is this? You know, and so you give them enough context, and if they say, I'm not sure what to do here, you can see it. And now, granted, we've been doing this for so long, we can probably see it a lot quicker, and we can recognize the angst where somebody's like getting frustrated. But that being said, a developer does a paper prototype, grabs somebody who doesn't know what's going on. You know, there's times where I've been at home, and I'll ask my wife, hey, I want you to take a look at this. You know nothing about it. Do this task. And I'll learn. Typically, I can learn something even from that perspective.
As opposed to in the past, we said, look at this, and they would go, ooh, pretty, you know, nice colors.
Right. So that's a great point. One of the reasons that we like to do both what we call the paper prototype or a low fidelity wireframe, and what I mean by that is a mock-up where I haven't jazzed it up, it's not Photoshop, the colors aren't there, is so that you don't confuse the feedback. You want feedback on the interaction design. So that when I say interaction design in terms of that term, what I'm saying is the workflow, the user experience of getting something done. If the first time a user sees that is with all the colors, you have to be careful about what feedback you're getting. Are you getting feedback that they're confused about getting the task done, or that they don't like yellow?
Right.
So that's another skill set, is the ability to extract that information from users. You know, you can't just say, do you like this? And they say no. You have to be able to say, what are you trying to do here? You know, get them to talk out loud, think out loud. Tell me where you're stuck. What do you think you would do? What were you expecting? A lot of times, the user will ask us a question. Well, what am I supposed to do here? And we'll turn that right around. It's almost, you know, it's like a psychologist. What would you expect to do here?
Yeah, you don't want to solve the problem. You just want to get them to think about the problem a lot. Yeah.
You know, and that's a great statement. One of the biggest challenges whenever I've taken developers with me on a field study, on a usability study, on a prototyping, is that the developer, because they've got good intentions, they want to solve the problem. They want to train the user during a field study, or they want to tell them how to do it because they want to solve the problem. And so for anybody as a developer who's saying, oh, I want to improve my design, I want to ask these things, what you have to be able to do is separate in your mind what the purpose of your session is that you're going to get a user on. And you can even say to the user, when we're all done with the session, I'll help you. Right. But during the session, I can't answer the question because what I'm trying to learn is, how do I make this better?
So have you ever slapped a developer's hand when they're going for the mouse?
I have had to, yes. And in fact, I can also say that as a customer with Gamal, with somebody from Gamal, when we jointly went, I had to get slapped early on in mine. I had to, you know.
It's a learned behavior,
exactly.
Right?
You know? It's a shut up.
Yeah. Well, and I think that if you're a developer on a field study like that, the third time you get your hand slapped, if you haven't learned at that point, then you don't need to go in the next field study.
Right.
So this is some great information. You know, we talked a lot about iteration. We talked about a lot about communications. You just shared something that I thought was, you know, really important, and that is, like, as a developer, you know, get involved, you know, with your designers. Actually, go on with one of those field studies. Is there anything else? Like, is there, you know, a book that would kind of, you know, resonate with more of a developer? And I just recently won a copy at a usability discussion of Don't Make Me Think.
Sure.
And it's really eye-opening. I'm only about halfway through the book, but I'm like, God, I'm so stupid. Is there anything like that you could, you know, advise, you know, the developers listening to the show?
There's a couple things. I think one question is there's a couple different types of developers, right? Are you in a corporate setting? And you're on certain types of projects there, and you're always with a certain group. If that's the case, one of the things that you definitely can do is you should lobby to try to get involved with getting out to see some of the customers every once in a while. The other thing from a corporate standpoint is, as a team, to really try to embed usability in overall into the life cycle. And that can be things like if you do personas, to actually, we'll have posters hanging around in the development areas so that they start thinking that they're developing it for people and not for this sort of amorphous user, but it's for Susan or it's for Joe. And they, you know, they think about it in terms of these people and these things. So that's one piece, is to really embed the conversation about the customers when you do it. But even if you're not there, if you're a consultant or if you're a small, smaller company, it's, you know, you have probably a little more luxury in that you can pick and choose your spots, but it's still about involving the users. When it comes to books, definitely, the Don't Make Me Think, is a great book. A lot of people in the development community are familiar with 37 Signals.
Yep.
Those guys preach sort of a simplify, mantra. They have a book called Getting Real. There's actually a bit of a dust up this past week in terms of 37 Signals and Don Norman have had some articles on the web going back and forth. But actually, in my opinion, it's because they're not actually talking to one another, because they're both articles.
Yeah.
All 37 Signals is saying is, we design stuff for ourselves. And they don't mean it in my opinion anyway, they don't mean it in an arrogant, selfish way. They mean we are the customer that we're designing it for. So we're our own use case. And so they're actually saying the same thing as Don Norman, which is, we aren't designing it without knowing who we're designing it for.
Right.
So you have to know your audience, I guess. But 37 Signals book, Get Real, is a very good book. I would say, actually, I think I have one right here. There's some great books by O'Reilly. If you're talking about web stuff, that is more of a best practice. So as opposed to the Don't Make Me Think, which is really more about almost a philosophy and about how to make things easier, designing interfaces and designing web navigation are some from O'Reilly that are some best practice things that you can get as well. So some of it depends on that. There's also a book called Paper Prototyping, which is phenomenal.
Cool.
It's got, you know, you don't read it like a cover to cover. It's like a reference book, and it is excellent. Trying to think of, there's another book, Communicating Design, and that's kind of what we're talking about here, which is using the same language that people use in order to talk through it in presentations. Paper Prototyping is by Carolyn Snyder, by the way.
Cool. We'll actually put a link in the show notes.
Okay, great.
I think we're pretty much at the end of our interview, but you touched on a lot of great stuff here. We'd like to have you back on the show to start drilling into some of these specific things. I'd love to have an episode on personas and then one specifically on, you know, the actual interface itself. And then it might even be a two-part one, because we could do one on, you know, web clients because they've got their own issues, and then one on rich clients.
Sure. That's I would love to do that. I think other people at Kamal as well. We've got a very multidisciplinary team. We've got people that focus almost exclusively on the field study aspect and the persona development. We've got the visual designers, who are the people that make the stuff that I mock up look a lot better.
Yeah.
And so I think that it does make sense to dive into some of those, because it's really diving into some of the specifics that can really help people understand where they want to go with their career, or just, okay, I know I'm a developer, but how do I make my stuff better?
Suck less is what I'll call it.
All right.
It.
Yeah. Yes, that would be another.
Well, thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer.
My pleasure. I look forward to talking again.
So, Larry, that was a great interview. You know, so essentially what I learned from that is that there's no difference in working between designers and developers than there are just, you know, working amongst developers and developers, or developers and project managers. It truly is about communication, right? It's about breaking down those walls. And so, I mean, that's certainly kind of a, you know, you hear it time and time again, you know, communication is very important within project teams, and it's no different in this particular area as well.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, important things for, you know, designers and developers to start doing, to start communicating. And I think that there's a lot we can learn from each other. And I think that we'll talk to Kevin and some of the other guys at Kamal Design again. It's interesting, the two principals that started the company, they actually met working at Apple back in the 1980s. So they actually worked on the very first, like, Macintosh interfaces.
Wow.
I can't wait to get them on the show and kind of talk a little bit about the history.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's very interesting. That's way old school.
Way old school, yes.
I mean, compare the effects of that, you know, the graphical user interface had back then, and, you know, just a short, you know, 25, 27 years later, what a difference it is. I mean, yes, the technology's advanced, but also just the ideas and the principles about it has enhanced as well.
Absolutely.
So, so with that, I think we should move into a blog you should know. So this week, a blog you should know is actually, you know, kind of fitting with this whole designer, developer kind of space. There's actually a person that's, you know, really great guy that works in the technical evangelism team in Redmond, actually works pretty closely with Adam Kenny. His name is Karsten Januszewski. I hope I pronounce your name right, Karsten. But Karsten is actually, he's on the client platform evangelism team, the same team that Adam is, who we talked to last week. And actually was talking with Karsten quite a bit at the South by Southwest conference. And he's got a lot of great information around just this whole, like I said, the whole convergence with designers and developers and just the ideas behind the technologies around WPF and Silverlight. He's got a lot of great information on his blog. His blog is called iRhetoric, you know, so, but that's actually not the URL. His URL is actually rhizome.net/iRhetoric, and we'll provide a link on the show notes for that. I'm not going to even attempt to spell it out for everybody and bore them to tears, but certainly check out Karsten's blog. He's got a lot of great videos also up on Channel 9. And a lot of great information there.
Yeah, and for those of the listeners that don't know this, that we actually have a blog site, you know, at thirstydeveloper.com, because a lot of people may have just found it on the Zune Marketplace or on iTunes. So anytime we mention a link, and the guys at Gamal Design gave me a ton of links to put in this week's show notes. You know, some great books that, you know, we can learn more about the design process. So just go out to thirstydeveloper.com anytime we mention the show notes, and you'll actually get the hyperlinks there. You can go right to the site.
Yep, great point.
So my blog, you should know, is it's kind of interesting. I was a little concerned about bringing this up because it's actually Kathy Sierra's blog, and she has the Creating Passionate Users blog, you know, our CPU, as a lot of people like to call it, and it's at headrush.typehead.com. And Kathy, as you know, hasn't been blogging for the last year because of some issues that she had with some of the readers. But if you just go out there, she's got some great information still in the archives out there. And it's still got a wealth of knowledge, even though she's not added anything new to it.
Yeah, the content stays there.
Yep. And she's definitely, she's quit blogging because of the issues she had, but she didn't take down any of the old content. And it's kind of good to go out there and have a refresher course every once in a while.
Yep, absolutely.
So headrush at headrush.typeed.com.
Great. So we close her out?
Yeah, we should close out the show for this week.
All right. So once again, I'm Dave Bost. You can reach me at daveboss.com. And my good friend over there, Larry Clarkin, you can reach him at larryclarkin.com. And as always, Larry, where can they find us?
They can find us on Twitter and Facebook and at thirstydeveloper.com.
That's right. All right, folks, take care, and we'll see you next week. This is The Thirsty Developer, episode 16 for March 22nd. Developers or